All right, well, let's move into pragmatism. This is our second view of truth that we want to address here tonight. I will say in my experience that 99.9% of relativists will quickly drop their relativism when pressed. To say, you know, that you really believe that a suicidal cult is the same as a church that cares for the poor, or to say that a group that forces women to throw themselves on a burning funeral pyre, or that a group that goes and rounds up African Americans and hangs them in the name of God, you really think that that's equal with every other religion on earth? Most people, when pressed, will admit, I'm not really a relativist. I don't really think that's true. And I would assume many people, 99% of the people in this room would agree with that. That when pressed, we don't really believe all views are the same, equal expressions of God's revelation or God's truth. However, how do we differentiate? Where do we draw the line between a group that we say is with God and a group that we think is not with God? Well, enter pragmatism. A pragmatic view of truth will actually give us a basis upon which to say that view of spirituality is wrong and this view of spirituality is right. This is the way John Hick describes it. Now, I want to qualify this very clearly. Hick is not a pragmatist. If you want to read a good pragmatist, read Richard Rorty. But he's more into the pragmatic view of truth in politics, so I didn't want to quote him. But Hick, in his book, A Christian Theology of Religions, Hick adopts a pragmatic view of truth. I just want to read you this quote, and you can judge for yourself. He's a pluralist, but he would call himself a pluralist, not a pragmatist, but he adopts a pragmatic view of truth. This is the way Hick describes it. He says, one does not regard all forms of religion, including, for example, Satanism, or the Jonestown and Waco movements, as authentic responses to the real, that is God. So you see, he is separating the wheat from the chaff. He's saying, actually, there are some expressions of spirituality I don't think are equal. Well, what's his basis for saying that? How can you say that some religions are right and others are wrong? Well, he tells us, I think it's clear that this implicit criterion focuses on the fruits in human life. Later on page 111, he claims, quote, the observable moral and spiritual fruits in human life. When he's saying fruits, what he means is good deeds. If their religion, if their encounter with the real, produces love and compassion for other people, well, then that is our true encounter. If their encounter with the real or God or whatever you want to call it does not produce love and compassion for others, Hick says, well, we can draw the line right there. It's not whether the view is true or false. It's whether it works and produces fruit, produces something in the person's life. Let's just continue to define pragmatism. Before we start to look at it, I just want to give a real honest representation of what pragmatism teaches. The pragmatist does not say that all beliefs are equally true or valid. Okay. In fact, the pragmatist doesn't even care about truth at all. They don't care if it's true or false. Instead, the pragmatist evaluates beliefs based on what works. If it works for you, then that's a good religion. That's a good worldview. If it doesn't work for you or for others, well, then that's a bad worldview. Put that another way, the pragmatist looks to the results rather than the reality of the belief. It's the outworking in the person's life that matters. Here's the way Dr. Gregory House describes it. He says this in season 5. He says, religion is not the opiate of the masses. Religion is the placebo of the masses. Remember, Karl Marx was famously quoted for saying that religion is the opiate of the masses. The upper class, the proletariat, uses religion to keep, the upper class, the bourgeois, keeps the proletariat, the lower class, down by convincing them that there's an afterlife. It's an opiate. It drugs people to think going to their job every day matters in some eternal scheme. Well, he says it's not the opiate, it's the placebo of the masses. You know what a placebo is. That's where you go into the doctor and they don't have a medicine for you, but they give you a sugar pill and they actually charge you money for it, too. Sometimes they make it expensive. So you take this $5 pill, and when you eat the pill, what they found is that there are psychosomatic effects, meaning that your mind can affect your body and being healed in some minor ailments. You take a pill, it's supposed to help your headache, and since you paid a lot of money for it and they're telling you it's real, when you take it, boy, you just start to feel like your headache's going away. The one experiment we saw, I think it was back in 2005, was a Stanford University keg party where these upperclassmen at this fraternity, they brought all these kegs with O'Doul's beer, non-alcoholic beer, and they brought them down and, all right, boys, let's get to work. They brought all the young freshmen in and they were chugging these cans of beer, these cups of beer, and doing keg stands off this O'Doul's beer. Well, all the freshmen were walking around the party. They were dancing to rap music. They were hitting on girls. They had an inflated sense of self-confidence. And in the entirety of the whole event, there was no alcohol being dispersed. But they had that kind of placebo effect. They felt like, you know, they thought it was alcoholic, so that kind of affected them and it boosted their confidence. Well, the pragmatist argues the same thing. You know, religion isn't actually real, but if we convince people that it's true, well, it can have a positive effect in their life. You know, just think about the kid who believes that Santa Claus sees him while he's sleeping. He knows when he's awake. You know, parents can use this to actually get their kids to behave. You know, Santa Claus isn't real. He's not real, but actually, if you believe in Santa Claus, it will produce moral fruit in your life. Here's the way Isaac Brock, lead singer of Modest Mouse, describes it. He says, I'm 100% on the whole Christianity being a crock of you know what, pretty much. But I don't give a whatever if people are religious. Believe what you want, whatever makes the day easier for you. So he's like, Christianity, I'm sure, I'm 100%, it's false. It's not true. But, you know, if you want to believe it, I don't care. Whatever makes the day goes easier for you. If it works for you, it works for you. To put that another way, it doesn't matter if Christianity is true. It just matters if it works. I've met people like this. You know, I'm glad you found Christ. It works for you. That's terrific. Happy for you. But it just doesn't work for me. It just doesn't work for everyone else. A pragmatic model of spirituality. Well, now that we've defined pragmatism, let's dissect it. I'd like to give you three reasons why the pragmatic view of spirituality should not be adopted either. The first reason is that pragmatism is illogical. If we look at it closely, pragmatism is illogical. Let's look at that definition one more time. Pragmatism states, it doesn't matter if a belief is true, it just matters if it works. It doesn't matter if a belief is true, it just matters if it works. Now ask yourselves, can you believe in something without affirming that it's true? We can't affirm beliefs. We can't believe in something unless we're saying we believe that it's true. Could you imagine if someone said, I believe in something, I don't affirm to be true? That's impossible. What if they said this? I believe in something that I affirm to be false. That's equally impossible. You can't have beliefs without presupposing truth. The second point is we can't even have beliefs that work without affirming truth. Imagine if the nurse came in and she handed you the placebo, the sugar pill, and you said, is this the medicine for my headache? And she said, yes. And you said, what is it? She said, well, it's $5. We've tested it and it's made entirely of sugar. And you said, well, how's that supposed to help my headache? Well, see, if we give you the placebo and you eat it and you think it's medicine, it's supposed to help you. Lady, you just blew it. You just messed up. I'm supposed to think it's a placebo. I'm supposed to think it's medicine. Once I know it's a placebo, how is that supposed to work? So in order for this pragmatic model to work, you would actually have to believe that this thing was true before it could work in your life. Truth precedes belief. And more importantly, truth precedes beliefs that work. Secondly, pragmatism excludes personal relationships. It excludes personal relationships. This should scare you a little bit. If you're truly trying to find God, if you're seeking for God, this pragmatic model should scare you. What you're saying up front is, I don't ever want to come into a personal relationship with God because I'm only going to believe in things that work for me. What's sad is when people following this model go out and try and search for God, you know what they find? They always find a God that ends up looking like them. So if they're an extreme right winger, God ends up looking like a divine Rush Limbaugh in the sky. If they're extreme left wing, it's a divine Michael Moore. God ends up looking like them. God is not that we are made in his image, but that he is made in ours. You know, have you ever taken anyone to a buffet before? You can actually learn a lot about somebody when you take them to a buffet. If they're a health nut, they usually get things that are colored green. If, you know, they're not a health nut, they'll get the sugars and the fatty foods. If they're a weightlifter, they get a lot of protein. Well, under this pragmatic model, we're doing exactly the same thing. We're going up to God saying, you know, I like this part of Christianity. That's tasty. I like this part of Buddhism. That's tasty. I like this part of Islam. That's tasty. And, you know, I'm just going to put all this together and make my own God. Well, that's a buffet mentality. Really, you're just showing a lot about yourself. You're not showing anything about God, whether he's there or not. How does pragmatism exclude personal relationships? Well, imagine if a husband and wife were standing up there on the altar and the husband looked deeply into his wife's eyes and he said, I promise to be with you until death do we part, unless something doesn't work for me in this marriage. That would exclude personal relationships, wouldn't it? When you enter into a personal relationship, what you're saying is, I'm going to stick in on this relationship, whether it works for me or not. Imagine a courtroom witness who was brought on trial and he said, I swear to tell what works for me, the whole of what works for me, and nothing but what works for me, so help me God. No, it should be, I swear to tell what's true, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help me God. When we enter into personal relationships, we can't just say that lies are the same as truth. Truth matters, not just what works for us. This should actually be encouraging for some of us. Some of us who read through the Bible and they find things in there that they struggle with, demands that God makes. You know, like God says, you have to give your life to me in order to find it. When it says that we should serve others and that's the way we find fulfillment. Now, if you know these things, you're blessed if you do them. Or it's better, more fulfilling to give than to receive. You know, when people struggle with aspects of the Bible like that, that's actually a sign of encouragement that you found a real God. Okay, if we were making this up, if you were making up who God was and it wasn't actually there in reality, then what you would find is you would never struggle in your relationship with God. Because anything that didn't work for you, you would just revise. Well, here's the way that Pastor Tim Keller writes about it in his book, The Reason for God. He says, remember the Stepford Wives, the movie? The husbands of Stepford, Connecticut, decided to have their wives turned into robots who never crossed the wills of their husbands. A Stepford wife was wonderfully compliant and beautiful, but no one would describe such a marriage as intimate or personal. Now, what happens, he writes, if you eliminate anything from the Bible that offends your sensibility and crosses your will? If you pick and choose what you want to believe and reject the rest, how will you ever have a God who can contradict you? You won't. You'll have a Stepford God. It's a good point. If you just start to pick and choose the things that you like and reject the things that you don't, what you actually have there is not a personal relationship. What you have is just me picking and choosing things that actually aren't out there in reality. He writes, so an authoritative Bible is not the enemy of a personal relationship with God. It is a precondition for it. Pretty good point. you're struggling with certain things in Scripture, that could be a sign that you're actually coming in contact with the real God. Number three, pragmatism denies truth. Pragmatism denies truth. What we're saying here is that truth actually matters. And I think in your heart of hearts, you believe that. Truth matters more than what works. And I'd like to give you a story to illustrate how you already believe truth matters. You believe that deep in your heart. I know you do. I do too. Truth really matters. The story's about Carol. Carol's a completely fictitious woman, just so you know. Carol is a 29-year-old marriage counselor. She lives with her handsome and successful husband named Dan. Dan's a doctor. He's good-looking, makes a lot of money. He bought a big, beautiful house for Carol out in the suburbs where they live. They live out the American dream there. They've got two efficient German cars. They take two vacations a year. They have 2.4 kids. Life is great for Dan and Carol. They have a well-manicured lawn, which their dog, Scruffy, poops on all the time. Doesn't bother Carol. She's got a nice big white picket fence. Life is great. She holds a class for all the single people in the neighborhood. The title of the class is How to Become a Successful Spouse. Good class. You bet, because scores of people from the neighborhood come out to hear Carol's talks every week on how to prepare for marriage. They love the class. Carol also counsels men and women in the neighborhood for marriage counseling. She charges $100 an hour. Boy, I'd like to make that kind of money. Charging people to help them with their marriages. And people flock to Carol. They love Carol. She has 20 to 30 appointments per week because they love getting counseled by Carol. Carol runs the block watch in the neighborhood. She has neighborhood block parties biannually. She has people over into her family's house for holidays and for important days of the year. She has them over for dinner parties, stuff like that. Every night when Carol lays her head down to sleep, and every morning when she wakes up, she's fulfilled, she's content, she's happy. Life is great for Carol. But there's just one thing I didn't tell you about Carol's life, of which she is completely unaware. Dan is cheating on Carol. And he's doing it with every woman in the neighborhood. Some of you women are like, handsome doctor, too good to be true, I knew it. Dan has slept with every woman in the neighborhood, and he's going around for seconds at this point. Every day during his lunch breaks at work, he's going out sleeping with women. Carol has no idea. Carol continues to run her class, How to Become a Successful Spouse, and scores of single people from the neighborhood come to take the class. You know why they take it? Because it's a free hour of comedy every week. They come out, they look pensive, they take notes, they look at her, and as she leaves the room, they mock and ridicule her behind her back for being such a joke. And scores of people get marriage counseling from Carol, but they don't do it for comedy. $100 an hour is not a very good price. They do it because when they meet with Carol and they see how lousy her marriage is in comparison to theirs, they think it's well worth the money. And so they pay out of pocket for her counseling. But don't feel bad for Carol. Carol's happy. Carol's fulfilled. Carol's content. Carol doesn't have a clue. Carol's beliefs make her happy. Carol's beliefs make her fulfilled. Carol's beliefs make her content. There's just one problem with Carol's beliefs. They're false. Carol's living a lie. Now, here's a question you need to ask yourself. Would I want to be Carol? Would I want my sister to be Carol? Would I want my daughter or my friend to be Carol? Of course you wouldn't. Of course not. Before you answer that question, remember, Carol's beliefs work for her. Carol's beliefs make her happy. There's only one problem. They're not true. So truth really matters. And the Bible is unashamed at coming forth saying, Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. By coming to Christ, we come in relationship with the true and living God, the loving God, the one who's actually there, who can help us. It matters what's actually true. Now, when it comes to us in our relationship with God, our situation is actually far different than Carol's. Carol's situation is far different. You see, if we brought the truth to Carol, that would be painful. That would hurt. And that, she'd probably be tear-filled. She probably wouldn't even want to hear it when you told her. But in our situation, you know, you might be sitting here tonight thinking, what if I'm Carol? What if I'm believing in something that maybe works for me, but isn't actually true? Well, the Bible says that when we come into the truth, it's not bad news. It's not like we're coming into this truth that's gross and we don't want to hear about it. It would hurt our feelings. The Bible actually teaches that God's message is good news, that you can have a relationship with God free of charge. Well, it's not free for God. God paid everything at the cross. It's free for you. And so the Bible teaches that you could come into a relationship with God free of cost. And that would actually be sweeter than believing in something that we're just making up ourselves. Well, that's all I had for tonight. I guess we're letting out early. Do we have any questions about anything we covered here? Yeah. Right. That's a very good question. The question is, in the new atheist literature, are they, it seems like they do harp on the atrocities of the church, quote unquote. Are they willing to be redirected toward what's actually true, what Christianity actually teaches? It's hard to tell. There's so much rhetoric wrapped up in a lot of the writing that you're wondering if they really do want to be redirected or not. Of course, we would point out that in other worldviews, when they go on coercive torture of people to adopt their worldview, sometimes that's perfectly consistent within the worldview. At least with Christianity, we can say if people do that, if they act violently or cruelly to other people, that might happen. But at least there's a fail-safe set up within the worldview where we can come back to what Jesus actually taught. Jesus said, my kingdom is not of this world. John 18. He said, if it was, my followers would bring swords and fight. He said, actually put your sword away. We shouldn't be going through doing that kind of thing. At least we can say that under the Christian worldview, that's inconsistent. And we have a fail-safe put up inside there. Whereas other worldviews, they can't say that. Yeah. Yeah. So the notion that God is out there for his own glory, and why would we want to follow a God who is just out there for his own glory? It's a good question. You know, in the book of Isaiah, we keep seeing that theme repeated. I will not give my glory to another. I will not share glory with false gods. I guess the answer would be twofold. The first answer would be, from God's perspective, if we start worshiping and following things that aren't actually true, then that would lead to a self-destructive kind of a life. So if we started to believe in a God who told you to go on a mass suicide rampage, from God's perspective, he doesn't want his glory being given over to a false God that's not actually real. And the second thing we could point out is in the Gospel of John, well, we could ask the question, how is it that God glorified himself? And the Gospel of John says that Jesus glorified himself by hanging naked, bloody on a cross, so he could die for us. So you would expect, one would expect that if this infinite, all-powerful being existed, when he says, I want to give glory to myself and not to others, we would expect him to be barking orders in a top-down way. Instead, he humbled himself to the point of death, and that was what he was talking about when he was speaking of glory. He wanted to actually take care of us in just an incredible, unthinkable way. Yeah. So the question is, what about the person who says, you know, I don't really think that there is any ultimate significance or meaning or moral goods or bads, but I just pretend like it's there, even though it's not. Well, I guess I'd have big problems with that. I guess I would just say, wouldn't you rather adopt a view where this actually is true? You know, even if all things were equal, even if there was no evidence for one or the other, wouldn't you just prefer one that it lines up with the thing that you're already striving toward? And the second thing I'd point out is that idea of the placebo effect, that the more you know, that you're taking a placebo, the less it's able to work for you. So the more you know that none of this is actually true, the less you're able to strive toward that. And I want you to be honest and think about that, whether you're being consistent with what you actually believe. The more you believe what you believe, the less you'd be able to follow it. So I think there would be a real terrible tension there. Yeah. Well, it seems like what you're saying is the guy believes that morality is objective. It is actually real. But there is a such thing as the good, something that we should be doing. You know, the idea of raping a woman for pleasure, that's wrong. We shouldn't do that. The idea of caring for a child and raising them, that's a good thing. So it seems like he's agreeing that there is such a thing as objective good and objective bad. Well, I guess what you'd want to press is, now that we agree that there is such a thing as an objective good and objective bad, what's your basis for believing that? So if someone said, I don't think we should care for that child, I think we should abuse that child, what would be your basis for saying, I disagree, and actually my view should actually be binding on you as well? Well, he might say, well, that person's conscience is malfunctioning, or when you do good things, people scratch your back in return, and none of us want to be malicious because we get thrown in prison. But then are we really saying that we're reducing moral actions to just if we get caught, that it's really nothing more than just behaviorism and being caught or being punished? We're really saying there's no difference between one and the other? Well, if that's the case, then what happens if the Nazis would have won in World War II? Would it have been right if they went out and started persecuting Jews en masse all the way across Europe? Well, if might makes right, then that would have to be. If you're saying that there's an objective moral law that's binding, independent of human action, well, then the best explanation for that would be a moral lawgiver, capital L. And I think the best explanation would be a transcendent, supernatural, not natural being who is himself the sum of all moral value. And out of his moral value, he would express these kind of laws. You know, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. You shall not steal. You should care for the poor, that sort of thing. So I guess I would just ask, if you believe in a moral law, doesn't that imply a moral lawgiver? You know, you would never show up to a pharmacist and have a prescription with no signature. The pharmacist would say, who prescribed it? Well, no one prescribed it. It's just a prescription. You know, prescriptions imply prescribers. Laws imply lawgivers. So I guess if he agrees with that, ask him what his basis is. Yeah. Well, I guess I would direct you back to the idea we talked about in our very first class, which is the concept of urgency. That according to the Bible, when we get there, that's going to be too late. The Bible says in Hebrews 9:27 that we actually live once and then comes judgment. But we need to make that decision whether we're with God before that ever occurs. So the notion that we can actually stand before God and then choose, God did not set it up that way. God wanted you to decide now rather than later. And you could just point out that, you know, if that's true, which is what the Bible teaches, then this could happen at any moment. You know, you might think that you're guaranteed another 50 years to figure that out. The Bible gives no such guarantee. The Psalms, Psalm 136 says that God has our days numbered, that we should not exceed them. God knows exactly how long you're going to live, and he set a time limit for you to make a decision there. I had a buddy who was out at a bar years ago. They're sitting down talking about spiritual things, and he felt really pushed or something. He felt like God was telling him to share Christ with his friend at the bar. It's a true story. I was a trustworthy friend. He said, I felt urged to do that, and I started bringing up spiritual things with him. And he said, in the middle of this bar with the boombox blaring and people drinking and screaming, this guy decided to receive Christ right there on the spot. He was that propelled to do that. And he said he called him up the next day to talk to him about it, and he kept getting his voicemails. He found that guy went home and had a heart attack that night. He literally did it right before he died. And, you know, Jesus taught a parable where he said, it doesn't matter if it's in the morning, the noon, or right before quitting time. God gives equal grace to each person. I don't think that guy came up and faced God and God was like, you wasted your whole life except for the last 3 hours. I think God was like, man, I'm so glad to have you. And it was just in time. So we got to encourage people. We don't have forever to think about this. And we should make a decision if we feel like the evidence is pointing in that direction. Yeah, this will be our last one. Well, I would say to the person who believes in the entirety of the Hebrew Bible that the Old Testament, or what the Jews would just call their Bible, the Hebrew Bible, it does speak about an afterlife. It speaks in Isaiah 26, I think it's verse 19, Ezekiel 37. Job said, I will see my Redeemer in my flesh after death. And Daniel 12:2, it speaks of a resurrection from the dead, some to life and some to death. And Jesus quotes that passage in John 5:28 to describe that actually this is not purely a New Testament phenomenon. Now, I don't believe the afterlife was fully elucidated in the Hebrew Bible, but that was brought through Christ to be fully unpacked and explained, because Christ talked about eternal reality more than anyone else in the entire Bible. It could have been that God made that clear, that there is an afterlife in the Old Testament, but fully unpacked that in the New Testament. You've also got cases of Enoch in Genesis 5, where it says he went to be with God without dying. There are cases of hints here and there, right from the beginning of the Bible. Job, and Job is one of the earliest books of the Bible, and then Genesis 5 is early as well. And Ecclesiastes 3:11, that God put eternity in their hearts. So I guess I'd pull out those verses and just say this is not a New Testament invention. It is found in the Hebrew Bible. Well, I said we were going to get out early. Let's get out early. You guys want to pray and then we'll close up?